Hey. My name is Bill Matthews, and I'm an alcoholic. And what an amazing opportunity to come and share a bit of my experience, strength, and hope with all you fine, fine people. My goal is not to come here and inspire anybody. Lots of us get inspired, and then we go home and forget. My goal is to encourage you to take action, because that's what it's going to take to recover from alcoholism. You know, action dispels overwhelm. So if you're in here and you feel a bit overwhelmed about this process, it's just about taking some action. I was sitting at the table, and there's a bunch of zip ties over there, and I was thinking, is this part of like a newcomer toolkit? You know what I mean? Like, we're going to zip tie people to their chairs just so they can stay a while. There's a few people in my life, and my sobriety date is May 20th, 1988, which means I'm coming up on a birthday, which also means I'm the newcomer compared to these other people. It's a strange joke because I used to be a young person in AA meeting. You know, I was a young people in AA. I came in here at 21 years old. And now here I am at a long-timers meeting. It seems like yesterday, but yet it also seems like so long ago. Father Time has no opponents. He's undefeated, right? And to have my beautiful wife introduce me, we've been married. We're long-timers in the marriage game as well. We just celebrated 31 years of marriage. We actually met at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It was a Friday night speaker meeting in Palmdale. It's at the Palmdale Hospital. You literally could smoke in the cafeteria. It's funny to say, I tell people, I got sober in the 1900s. So you can't have successful long-term marriage in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife will tell you what it takes to have a long-lasting marriage is to be two good forgivers. And then I also know the three best words to stay married is, you're probably right. Anyway, this isn't a Marriage Anonymous meeting, but like I said, I got sober when I was 21 years old, which means I must have been doing a lot of crazy stuff really, really young. I took my first drink when I was 11 years old. It was a warm, tall can of Schlitz malt liquor. It had a blue bowl on it, and I liked it. That same year, my brother gave me a little tab of paper. You guys all know, tab of paper. I was going to write. I said, what damage can that do? I took it, and I spent the next 10 years tripping. And that's why I got here at 21 years old. I thought I was just partying. I thought I was just having a good time until I ended up in jail for drunk driving and a lot of other things. And they said, hey, if you want to go to a place called Acton Rehab, it's a really great place. They have women and parachute jumping and golf and all this great stuff. They don't have that stuff. What they did have is Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. In 20 minutes, I can't tell you a lot of stuff, but I qualify to be here. I weighed 135 pounds and my teeth were not as pretty. I have AA recovery teeth. And I got there and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were reading the doctor's opinion. And they told me the description of an alcoholic. Prior to that, the description of an alcoholic for me is a man living on the street, wears a trench coat, has a little bit of puke on his jacket, and he can't keep his crap together. I'm just a kid. I'm just partying. I'm just having a good time. They started talking about the obsession and the allergy, and when you're not drinking, all you're doing is thinking about drinking. And I was like, holy shit. I'm an alcoholic, man. This really sucks. I mean, I'm 6 months after my 21st birthday. And once they read it, I was like, you can't unread it. There's something I got to do. I think I'm going to not drink. But I'm going to keep smoking weed, man. Never got in any trouble doing all that. And then shortly after, I figured it out, man. Within that 90 days, I figured out I got to, it's the whole deal, man. It's about changing my life. I can proudly say that I'm fortunate enough to stay. I have been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it just means I was fortunate enough to get around the right people. What I want to state in 20 minutes that I'm a recovered alcoholic. Doesn't mean I'm not an alcoholic, but I'm recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. The book tells me we're here to do that, to recover. And if you're here and you've been here for years and you haven't recovered, there's only one person to blame, and it ain't your sponsor. If you broke your arm, do you want to spend the next 15 years recovering from a broken arm? No, we come in here to rebuild our life, you know. I still have alcoholism, but I don't suffer from it. I don't suffer from the obsession to drink. The most powerful thing that ever happened to me is another man taking me through the steps and getting me to the third step and getting on my knees and making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And I can tell you from that moment on, the obsession to drink was removed. Something overwhelmingly powerful happened to me. Never thought that. There's no way I'm ever going to wake up and not want to do something. Everybody I know does something. And I'm only 21 years old, man. My life is doomed over. Such the opposite. I began to live when I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a brother that died on Christmas Day in 1983. He's 32 years old and he died of alcoholism. Died alone in a hotel room. And I don't believe you ever heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous. It is my responsibility and duty to make sure that when anybody anywhere is suffering from alcoholism, that the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous is here. Lots of people are searching for purpose these days. Oh, what's my purpose? What's my purpose? If you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a primary purpose. It's to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. However, are we fit for that purpose? Have I done the work necessary to be fit to help another alcoholic? It means what I'm supposed to do is uncover and discard the stories, the crap that's been holding me back, the blame. I've been blaming everybody my whole life. If it wasn't for Dad, if it wasn't for where I lived, if it wasn't for school, if it wasn't for them, I'd be all right. All of that is crap. I created that. What part did I play? I'm not a victim. I must take responsibility for my actions, and it was in that freedom to go, man, I caused most of that. And now I get to go make amends. And now then you begin to be spiritually fit for that purpose to take another man through the book. I can take somebody through the book. And I can take him to meetings, but I can't give him the one thing that's going to keep him sober for the rest of his life. And that's a God of his own understanding. The main purpose of the book is to find that power. And as a result of working the steps, I found that. And I've had a spiritual awakening, and that's what I'm supposed to share. And what's awesome is to watch that happen to others. It breaks my heart to see people come in here and don't do the work and tell people that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. My sponsor, who's passed now, and some of you might have known him, his name was Spencer Schramm, and he taught me that Alcoholics Anonymous works 100% of the time if you do what's outlined in the first 164 pages of the book. And as a result of that, I've stayed sober. But in order to do that, you got to be willing to put yourself on the hook. And you're like, what I mean is, who Danny took on being the speaker getter. He put himself on the hook. He took some responsibility, the chairperson of the place. We're putting ourselves on the hook to be responsible. Who's the leader of the meeting, the secretaries of the meetings? That you got to put yourself on the hook to be responsible to yourself and to others. And when you do, when you're willing to put yourself out there, you begin to become that person, to that responsible person. There's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that don't put themselves on the hook. And then they complain about how terrible things are ran. My wife and I have a child together, and then I have a 38-year-old daughter. I have 5 beautiful grandchildren. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't just help me not drink. The book says somewhere that to think that this is just not about not drinking, that man is unthinking. This is so much more. I've found a God that has solved all my problems. It's taught me to be a responsible human being, a father, a son, a brother, a boss, a coworker, a friend. And to think I went to rehab because I didn't want to spend all my time in the 9500 block in LA County Jail. If you ever heard of that place, it's a real, real drag. But what I found is a life beyond my wildest dreams, and a friend and a fellowship. I mean, I've got people that we've been walking this road for well over 30 years together. We've been through deaths and births and all kinds of stuff. I will share that I would not be here today if it wasn't for my mother, man. Man, I'm a mama's boy. Dad was born in 1928, and I only knew he loved me because he let me live in his house. But man, Mom was a lover, and she tolerated my shenanigans until I got sober. And I could say that when she passed away, that she had forgiven me for my trespasses against her, and I had made amends to her. You know, they talk about tough love and it's really easy to give people advice about, you got to kick them out. Mom never kicked me out, man. I always knew that I had a place to go. Mom loved me until I could love myself. I don't know if it's good or bad or right or wrong, but that's what she did. And if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be here today. Today is my mother's birthday. And my mom passed away a few years ago of cancer. And I watched her take her last breath. Before she passed away, I committed to her that I was going to run her age in miles. She was 72 years old. That's a lot of running. And I set out to keep that promise, because that's what people in Alcoholics Anonymous do. We keep our word. And, you know, when she passed away, I had to find a place. Where do you run 72 miles? And I found a 100-mile foot race in San Diego, because it sounded like it's going to be nice, great, cool weather. Well, there's a town called Julian that's in San Diego, but it ain't cool weather. And I set out to do what I told my mom to do. I was going to do, because people in Alcoholics Anonymous keep our commitments. And I started that morning, that Saturday morning, running and running and running and moving and moving. And I wanted to give up and quit. And I just kept going, no, but I committed to Mom. I committed to my mother. And then I had a friend help me at mile 50. We get pacers, and I'm going, now it's through the night. And I'm like, these people are giving up. I want to give up, man. My knees are hurting too. And I just like, no, this driving force. We don't quit. We keep our commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I hit mile 72, I stopped and I looked up and I said, we did it, Mom. Sad thing is, I still had a marathon length to go to finish. But I finished it. Because we finish what we start in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, my goal wasn't to come here and inspire you. It's to encourage you to take action. This is a program of action. And God could have chose anybody to do his work, but he chose the drunkard, the cast out, the nobody to do his work. There's a pamphlet that says we were chosen or why we were chosen. It's by no mistake you were put in Alcoholics Anonymous. You are uniquely qualified to help people that nobody else can help. You know how many people told me what I should do prior to getting to Alcoholics Anonymous? It wasn't until another man sat down with me and said, I understand. I get it. Let's do this together. This is what I did. And as a result, I'm standing here today healthy, you know, sober, with a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I'm really, really was excited about the opportunity to come up here and thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to go ahead and invite up our next speaker, Kevin P. Come on up, Kevin. Thanks for coming.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here, and it's good to be sober. I still can't quite figure out how I'm here, you know, truthfully. The long-timer, it's like, oh, my goodness gracious. I mean, like, I can't believe how much I related to Bill. And our stories are really similar. And from the very beginning when I saw Bill, I'm like, I just don't like this guy. You know what I mean? Something about the cut of his jib, his level of serenity, you know what I mean? Like, he just seems so happy, joyous, and free. He's suspect, that's for sure. And that's the truth. And I want to thank Danny for asking me. You know, and honestly, I thought Danny never liked me. We've had multiple conversations, and he's always been kind of short with me. And it's like, I don't really care. You know, you don't like me? And then, like, last night, he sent me a text, and he said, you know, I really respect you. And I was just like, I just couldn't believe it. Truly, I couldn't. Not that people can't respect me, that he doesn't. And my perception was so wrong. And that's my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that my perception is just wrong. You know, left to my own devices, I don't want to wear a suit. Bob was giving me such a hard time last night. His sweet wife just said, you know, it'd be a really good idea. But he was just like coming on. He doesn't even have the sense to take off his hat inside. And he's giving me a hard time about a suit. I mean, you know, but the truth of the matter is, you know, you can follow even the people who are broken, you know what I mean? Bob's a prime example of that. You know, sober 54, 55, 56 years, and I just can't even believe I'm standing here before you, 35 years sober. You know, I got sober February 1st, 1988, and I was young, younger than Bill, and I had the exact same experience. I started drinking and using drugs, and it did something for me, something so perfect. And it did something for me, and it did something for my brothers. Both my parents are alcoholics. They've identified from the podiums in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, they weren't able to stay sober. My dad drank himself to death. I know the good and the bad of alcoholism. You know, I've always had the ability to look around and see how I was different from everybody. I just had that innate understanding from the very beginning, whether it was because we were poor or our parents were immigrants, or because we didn't have like the right clothes or the right haircuts, or we didn't bathe on the same schedules that everyone else did around us, and our house was just our house. It's this morning I got up and I had to speak at a 7:30 meeting, a Zoom meeting, and it was the best thing about it is that there's these guys on Zoom. Do you guys know about this? Where they pretend like they're an AA and they're actually not, and then they put on like porn and they like disrupt the meeting. I was like, that's the greatest thing ever. I mean, that's exactly what I would have done. You know what I mean? Like from the very beginning, me and my brothers, we'd go around, we'd break people's sprinkler systems. You know what I mean? Just for the hell of it. You know what I mean? Like. Because I was drawn to disrupt. And, you know, it's like I got up this morning and my wife made me coffee and she made me an omelet. And it was just like there was like no tension in the house, and there was no violence, and there was no violence last night, and there was no arguments. That's not to say there's never any arguments, but it's not like it was when I grew up. When I grew up, there was a level of anxiety that pervaded that household from the time I can remember. My earliest memories are my dad hitting us. You know what I mean? Like, it was, I'm not saying that for sympathy. There's plenty of other people around here who've had it worse than I did. But there was a lot of violence, you know? And I look at our house today, I get up. It's just, I've been married over 30 years also, and my motto is more like, I'm always fucking right. I eventually get around to, okay, I might be wrong, but I haven't quite got those three words down yet. I got to get them from you. I've already forgotten what they were, but... You know, I mean, we have just this incredible relationship, and that's the thing that I was struck by in the room. It's like, in this room, I'm surrounded with people with a lot of time who I've known for a long time, and I'm surrounded with other people by other people who don't have a ton of time, who I'm involved in their life. It's like people cascade through your life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's like I love enthusiastic Alcoholics Anonymous, and that will put me in different places. You know, I've gone to the Pacific Group, I've gone to the Downtown Young People's Meeting. Currently, I'm going to the Thursday night Back to Basics Men's Stag. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love enthusiastic Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to be involved. I'm on the committee. I love being on the committee. Like, I was disappointed I got a speaker thing. I didn't really want one of those. I wanted the committee ones, but they ran out of them. And it's like, it turns out Danny had three or four of them stashed away, so next year he could pretend like, no, I'm kidding. No. Yeah, Ron's got them. So, it's like I come into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I know people and I've had really profound experiences with those people. And it's like my brother's got 31 years sober, just celebrated 31 years sober like a couple weeks ago. And it's like my younger brother's got, I think, 34 years sober and I have 35 years sober. And the life that I have is just so entirely different than anything I ever expected or wanted, you know? I can't say that I liked chaos, but I certainly kind of fostered chaos in my life. Like I said, from a young age, there was violence going on in my house, and it was just, for me, it affected me very, very profoundly. You know, for my brothers, not so much. My younger brother says he used to love when my parents would get into, like, really bad arguments, or, you know, and for me, I didn't like that at all. And I grew up, and I just, and it kind of, it changed the way I perceived the world, or maybe that's the way I always perceived it. I always perceived everyone else as a threat, a potential, like, violence could happen at any moment, and I just was at dis-ease and discomfort all the time. And I remember just sitting outside people's house waiting for them with just, like, this impending sense of discomfort, you know, or not impending, just a sense of discomfort. It was just, like, dis-ease all the time. And I would do things like, you know, like I said, there was violence in our house. There was violence outside our house. We were encouraged to get in fights all the time. My brother told a story the other day about how my dad had said, you know, go hit that guy because he's picking on your brother. And, you know, it was, everything was extremes. You know, my brother ends up kicking the guy in the face and breaks his nose, but he bloodies his nose in a pool. And it was like my dad would tell us, like, you know, go fight that kid. You know what I mean? Like, it was, like, always, and I would just do that. I started doing that, and I wasn't any kind of tough guy like Jacob or something like that, you know what I mean? It's not like I instilled fear in people's eyes when they saw me coming, but I was just, that was what you had to do in order to kind of get by. And in school, I just was like, I'm a teacher today, and I've been a teacher for quite a few years, and there's always that kid who's just the biggest pain in the ass. Kid's name is Gabe this year, right? And he just gets on my nerves. I mean, I'm telling you, I could take that kid outside and I could do physical harm to him and I wouldn't feel bad at first. Because he's so difficult, you know what I mean? And that was me. And I wasn't funny and I wasn't likable. I was just a giant pain in the ass to my teachers. And I would do everything I could to disrupt the class. And I was quick-witted and I was smart, so I could just break the pace of the class all the time. And it was just, and so as a result, I remember standing outside all of my classrooms all the time. Back in the day, they'd be like outside, you know what I mean? And as the year went on, their tolerance got less and less. So I'm like in the class for like 5 minutes, and then I'm outside for 50 minutes. And it's like that all the way through my senior year in high school, I can remember standing outside the classrooms. And it's like, I was just uncomfortable, and that's, and I felt the urge to disrupt things around me. My brothers and I decided one day just to shoot out the windows of our neighbor's windows, you know, the windows that faced our house. It wasn't like we were trying to be like clandestine, you know what I mean? It was like, let's just break shit. That's what we were compelled to do, you know what I mean? Like, egging houses. We had these Japanese people who were living up the street, and they were like new from Japan, and we would egg their house every night during the summers, because we were out playing like, ditch them, and we would just egg their house incessantly, like just break things and break in. We broke into the school. We knocked out the ceiling tiles. They were just like this. We shot bottle rockets up there. We lit the school on fire, and it was just like, why would you do that? It's like, why not? You know what I mean? Because that's what I felt like doing. Last little juvenile delinquent story. We were throwing dirt clods into this pool down below, and we did it for like 3 weeks straight. It was awesome because you would either throw it in the pool or it would hit the concrete and it would explode. And finally, I came up and caught my little brother. He was always the one who got caught. And we had to pay for the pool filter and stuff. But I was just compelled to do those things. And then when I was in high school, in middle school, I started drinking and smoking pot. And that need to do things was gone because that filled that hole. It was like a giant exhale. It was like, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. I have found what all of my fellows clearly already have, that ability to just be with their fellows and feel comfortable, because I just never felt that way. But when I got high or I got drunk, I was one of many, and I was totally fine with that. It was great. And from the very beginning, I can remember, I just did not have the ability to kind of regulate. You know what I mean? Like, I would go and do things with people, and we'd have a certain amount of drugs, or we'd have a certain amount of alcohol, and people would say, well, you don't have to do all of it. You know what I mean? And that just never made sense to me. You know what I mean? Like, if it's there, you know, me and my brothers, we drank. I remember my parents went to Santa Barbara, and we got, like, for, like, 14-year-old, 15-year-old, and 12-year-old, we got like 4 cases of beer for a night. You know what I mean? Like, and it was like, and it's just about getting completely wasted and blackout drunk. And I never even thought that blackouts were a problem. You know what I mean? It was like the speaker was talking about last night. It's just nothing but a time machine. You're drinking, you're having a good time, and then all of a sudden there's something else going on. And then it's like, and then the next morning, I don't think normal people have those kind of things where they don't really remember the night before. And it wasn't. And I talked to a person one time, and they're like, I blacked out, and I just knew that was too much. It was like, and I don't want to do that again. I was like, me and my friends, that was the deal. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like I thought it was a problem. And then I started using drugs a lot, and that never seemed like a problem. Like June... Well, not June, but Sue was talking about last night. The day before I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have even said I had a problem with drugs and alcohol. I'd had some unfortunate situations that were associated with drugs and alcohol, where I had overshot the mark and I was kind of losing my mind. But I never made the correlation between you're going insane and you're using a lot of drugs and drinking a lot. And when I would go over the line and think I was in Nazi Germany and they were going to have do a live autopsy on me in the youth hostel in England. I was 100% convinced that was going to go on. And I just thought to myself, I gotta slow it down. I gotta, you know what I mean? I'm not going to do crystal meth for so many days in a row. I'll just dabble, a little bump, you know what I mean? And then there it is. It's just instantaneously back. You cannot conjure up the reasoning that you had for thinking that maybe it wasn't such a great idea. I can't the next day. And so what happens is I'm in this infinite loop of getting worse and worse and spiraling down and down. And there's hospital visits and there's, you know, concerned parents. But again, it's not because I'm an alcoholic. I never even heard of Alcoholics Anonymous the day before I came in. I had no desire whatsoever to even regulate, much less stop, because that was my answer. And if you had an answer and you were as screwed up as I was, you're not going to surrender that just because you've had some unfortunate situations going on. But either fortunately or unfortunately, I got to a place where it was no longer possible to deny what was going on because I was in 5-point restraints. And I was in LA County Hospital, and I had 2 felonies and 5 misdemeanors hanging over me. And my brother came down to see me, and I was not even coherent. I mean, I was gone, like literally gone. And then even then, I wouldn't have said I was an alcoholic. I was just insane at that point. And they let me out to go into a closed facility, a psychiatric hospital, and that's where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll never forget, I always talk about this when I'm speaking, I never want to forget that when the first time I came into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I just said to myself, nope. Whatever this is, this ain't it. You know what I mean? Like, there was a bunch of guys like Danny Tubbs there. You know what I mean? They were old, and they were bitter. And then, sure, there was some guys like Zach, but I thought he was trying to come on to me to tell you the truth. He seemed really concerned about me and wanted, oh, you're a newcomer? It's like, hey, buddy. All right, like, pump the brakes. You know what I mean? Like, and it wasn't until I met a couple guys who were into punk rock, and I was really heavily into the punk rock scene, and I met them, and they were sober 5 years, and I just could not even believe it. And they went to AA meetings, and I just thought, this might be able to work for me. And I was not willing to do anything like come to meetings on time or take commitments or not talk in the back of meetings or not get in fistfights in front of conventions or register for conventions for that matter. I was just like kind of parasitic hanging around trying to like pull the newcomer girls out into our circle of sobriety. You know what I mean? And it was like, but what happened for me is I just was lucky enough to stick around until I got to a point where I was willing to do the lamest stuff. You know what I mean? And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. If you're fairly new, buckle up. You got a lot of lame in your future. All these things they profess from the podium that are just so wonderful, they're so lame. They really are. I'm on the committee. It's so good to be part of the committee. Oh, that's so great to take your commitment. And by the way, I am the co-table washer on Thursday night. I just want to, from a public forum, I want to point that out, okay? Will and Joe, you're attesting to this, okay? Because my older brother, who gloms onto attention, not just from good-looking women, but from also from the podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous, is taking the credit every week as being the table washer. And I am there with him, and I am doing the job. And in fact, I bought the 409 that goes onto the table. So, yes, Alcoholics Anonymous is so lame, and you have to do these things that are so, it's humiliating, it truly is, like ask someone to sponsor you. The amount of humiliation I felt when I asked that guy, will you be my sponsor? I always say, it's just like when I asked this girl, Laura, to be my girlfriend when I was in eighth grade, I passed her a note, will you be my girlfriend? If yes, check here. If no, check here. You know, it was the same thing, and it was, he was so serious about it. But what ended up happening is I had that willingness because I just had not given AA a shot. And I was still getting arrested. And this is well into sobriety, 3 years into sobriety. I was still getting arrested, still getting into fights. I knew I wasn't where I should be. And so I started working the steps. And it's not like my life turned around and everything just became perfect. In fact, on any given day, my life is completely messed up. I can make bad decisions, string 3 bad decisions together, and I got a bad day. You know what I mean? And if I start justifying those decisions on top of that, then we're in real trouble. And that's why I come around here to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I can go out on the golf course with, like, Bob, you know? And I can see at 56 years, you can still act like a complete lunatic. No, but truthfully, I can go out on the golf course with Bob and I can tell him what's going on. You know what I mean? I have hard things that have gone on in my life. My dad drank himself to death. That was tough. You know, my youngest daughter was born and she had a congenital heart defect. And my wife and I, it was really hard. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. was thinking that I was going to have a child that was going to die. And what did I do? I showed up. I suited up and I showed up. I started going to that Wednesday meeting because I needed to be around people like Julie St. John, who've lost children, just in case that happened. I needed to have examples in my life. And as a result, just making these small decisions on a regular basis, showing up when I say I'm going to show up, trying to make amends when I step out of line, trying to be welcoming and loving to people, trying to just constantly get better and understand that this relationship with God that I cultivate will make me more comfortable and make me a better human being and just a better member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of a sudden, like I said, it's a blink of an eye. It's 35 years later. And like when I was new, the old timers would come up and they'd have oxygen in a tank. You know what I mean? They'd be like, you know what I mean? I'd be like, yeah, sure, you're an AA. Look at you, for God's sake. You ain't got many days left. You may as well get up there on the podium and tell them what happened, because at least we'll get a record of it. But, you know, but a blink of an eye, and there it is. You know what I mean? 35 years later, I have this great life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love my fellows. I don't love everybody, but I am welcoming and hopefully loving. I'm willing to sponsor guys and take them through the steps. And if you're new or nearly new, get a sponsor. Get some commitments. Go to a meeting where they're enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous in your life. It'll change things.
All right, our last speaker is Lee C. All right, let's give her a hand.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, honey.
You bet.
Well, hello, my fellow alcoholics. I am so excited to be here. I mean, I should take that back after hearing Kevin, but oh my gosh. How can you top that? do we have any newcomers here? Real newcomers? Oh, wonder. Oh, I'm seeing some hands. Oh. I'm so glad that you're here. And I just want to say one thing that was said to me when I was a newcomer. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. And I'm telling you, I am humbled by the number of miracles that I've been given in this program. Big ones, little ones, it's amazing. I mean, this is the most amazing program. I mean, I've gone to church, I've gone belonged to clubs. I have never, ever belonged to an organization where you find everything you need in your life. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that. I can't, sometimes I, some days I wake up and I can't believe how wonderful my life is. In spite of, I mean, I'm not perfect, but it's, I have so many friends that, and oh, I do want to say one thing. If you come and I recognize you, but I might not remember your name because I'm just a little over 3 months away from being 87 years old. And that, I'm telling you, you do not remember things very well when you get to be to that age. I'm just here to tell you. You know, when I see, I'll be driving through like Taco Bell or someplace, you know, and there'll be some young girl on the cashier or a young guy, and I want to say to them, don't get old. but the alternative's not good, so yeah, I keep my mouth shut. But you know, I don't know at what point I became an alcoholic. I drank for a number of years. I lived in Malibu, and we used to have a lot of beach parties. And that's where I started drinking, was at the beach parties. And then, this was in the 50s, and then in Topanga Canyon, marijuana grew wild. Who knew? Well, the guys knew, and the guys used to go up and harvest it, dry it out, and roll it, you know, into cigarettes for us. Well, the only reason I didn't, and this is true, the only reason, because I would have loved to have smoked weed, the only reason I would have, oh, anything to, you know, get me out of myself. But anyway, the only reason I didn't smoke weed was because my girlfriend Patsy said, honey, you get such the munchies. You get the munchies like crazy. When you... Now, I was doing everything to lose weight because I had a tendency to gain weight. And I mean, I was like walking my dogs 2 and 3 miles every day. I was playing tennis 5 or 6 times a week. I was swimming at the Y. I've always been a member of the Y from Santa Monica in the Valley and also here at Ventura. And, you know, I just did everything I possibly could to try and keep my weight down. So there was no way I was going to touch one of those cigarettes. Although I saw people getting so mellow, I was so envious, you know. But I really don't know. I drank, and I didn't start drinking until later in the day. And the reason for that was I used to be a very fastidious person, and everything had to be perfect. In fact, on the coffee table where I'd have, you know, the magazines laid out, if one was askew, I'd have to fix it. You know, I was really ridiculously fanatical. But anyway, I had to make sure that my house was clean, that I did all my errands that before I started drinking, so that I would go to the, you know, to the bank or to the market or to the cleaners or wherever I had to go. I made sure that I had all that done. And you know, and I was really dedicated to being this so-called good wife. But anyway, and my husband was a workaholic. He loved his job. He was a director of space and missile systems at Litton Industries in the Valley, and he worked long hours. He'd be gone by 7 in the morning, and he wouldn't come home until about 8:30, quarter to 9 at night. I'd always have his dinner in the oven, being a good wife, you know, and I'd be passed out on the couch. That was my routine. I'd drink and pass out, drink and pass out. So my husband would come home, he just thought I was napping, you know. I was drunk as a skunk. And I don't know if at what point he really realized I was an alcoholic. It certainly didn't want to interrupt his way of life, his workaholism. But anyway, you know, and then at some point I'd wake up and I'd crawl on all fours upstairs and go to bed. But, you know, it was a case where it wasn't that I wanted a drink, it was that I needed a drink. And I don't know at what point that was, but all of a sudden I had no control over my drinking. And I was confronted by my doctor, wonderful, wonderful man. He used to say to me, "Don't come to me when you're sick, come to me when you're well and I'll keep you that way." He was phenomenal. And he said to me one day, because I always took vitamins, and he said, "You know, just eat a well-balanced diet. You don't need..." Americans have the most expensive urine in the world, you know. And you know, and he was dead on. He was a wonderful. But when he confronted me about my drinking and said he thought I was an alcoholic, I was flabbergasted, because I always went in to his office sucking on a Sensen. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember those tiny little, they were powerful little Sensen. So I thought, well, what's with this? He's telling me that he thinks I'm an alcoholic. Well, it wasn't until I think 5 years later I finally asked him, how did you know that I was an alcoholic? I said, "It was always sucking on the Sensen." He said, "Oh, I knew that." But he said, "You didn't realize." He said, "I did all my internship at the Mayo Clinic working with alcoholics." And he said, "Alcohol comes out your pores. I could smell." And I was a straight gin. Don't mess up my gin with vermouth or an olive. Just give me straight gin on the rocks. And in the beginning, I bought the best Beefeaters, you know, until it just got so expensive, I went to Rock Gut. But anyway, you know, it was the pattern of my life was so boring. I was so boring, and I didn't know what to do about it. You know, when he sent me to this, my doctor said, "Okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and you're going to come and see me once a week and tell me what you're learning." Well, I thought, this is ridiculous. Well, I knew one gal that went to AA, so I called her and I said, Can I come with you? My doctor wants me to go to an AA meeting. I don't know why, but anyway. She said, sure, come along, you know. And she took me to this woman's meeting in Canoga Park. It was in a garage of a men's recovery house. And it was in a garage that they had meetings, and they had meetings there several times a week. So anyway, I went to this meeting, and I wouldn't admit I was an alcoholic, of course, because I didn't think I was. But anyway, they call on me, and I just say my name, and I pass. And I did that for 90 days. I sat, and what I did in those meetings, I sat and I listened to what everybody was saying. But you know what I did? I looked for all the ways I wasn't like them. And there were a lot of ways I found. Because I was just a home drinker. I didn't drive a car. Now, the next day, with this pounding headache at the base of my skull, I drove my car. So hungover. Oh, my God. I didn't get relief until I started drinking, you know, late in the afternoon again. But anyway, I had this routine going for me. And just still couldn't understand why he had me come in. So I'd go into him, and I'd argue with him, and I'd say, I'm not like, I didn't end up in the back of a trunk screwing some guy, you know? This is what I was hearing in these women's meetings, and it was shocking. It was shocking. Of course, the fact that I was a liar, cheat, and thief had nothing to do with that, but anyway, I just kept arguing with my doctor, and finally he got fed up with me, and he said, okay, Lee, if you haven't heard your story yet, then you're not going to enough meetings. I'm going to a meeting every day. Anyway, after the 90 days, I went out. I did my 90 days. Now, my best friend's daughter was being married down in Mission Viejo. As we're driving down there, I said to myself, I didn't say this out loud to my husband, I said to myself, well, nobody can deny me a glass of champagne to toast the bride. Everybody does that, right? Now, we were like family to this girl. There was two children in this family, girl and a boy. And they called us Aunt Lee and Uncle Roger. And we sat at the family table at the reception. We went to the beautiful wedding. By the way, the girl ended up not being married. She turned out to be gay. Later on, she found the permit, and she has been with this wonderful, wonderful woman for many, many years now. But anyway, that's a little aside. So anyway, I'm going to the reception. And I can remember it clearly. Oh, one thing I didn't tell you was I blacked out. I remember when at one meeting I went to this is after my sponsor forced me to go to mixed meetings, because for 2 years I just went to women's meetings, okay? And she finally said, look, you've got to go to mixed meetings now. And I don't want to go. She said, I don't care if you don't want to go. You've got to go. She said, the women talk about their feelings. The men talk about the disease. And I found her to be true about that, you know. So anyway, I was going to the reception. And I can remember this clear as a bell. See, when I drank, I always remembered what I did. And that was horrible, because I was living with all these incidents, you know. And yet that didn't stop me. That didn't stop me from drinking. But anyway, we go there. And I can remember we go into this beautiful country club where they had the reception. And you had to take two steps up to get to the main area where the reception was. And as I mounted these two steps, a waiter was going by, and he had a tray with filled alcohol, champagne glasses filled with champagne. And I took one off the tray, downed it, followed him, put it back on the tray, and took another one. Well, I was off and running, as you know, and I was drunk as a skunk. And we had this beautiful meal and everything, and. things that they had was in the middle of this long table for the family, they had a beautiful carved ice swan, a gorgeous swan. Yeah, I kicked my heels off, got up on the table and rode the swan.
All right. Didn't see that coming.
No. All
right. And it's all on videotape. I've never seen the videotape because I remembered everything that I did. And telling you, when I got off of that squad, now this is back in the days when we used to wear pantyhose, nylon pantyhose. Women don't do that anymore. But anyway, I had these nylon pantyhose on and they stuck to the ice. And when I got off, they ripped. And here was these pantyhose stuck to this beautiful swan. Oh. Of course, everybody loved it. They thought, you know, I mean, I was, when I got home and I realized what an ass I'd made of myself, you know, it was pretty sad. But anyway, so the next morning in my garden, I'm digging in my garden and I start sobbing. And I knew that it was all over, that I couldn't continue to behave the way I was. I was filled with self-revulsion, and I cried out to God. Now, I didn't have a relationship with God. I'd always gone to church. My mother was even a Sunday school teacher. I'd always gone to church, even after I married my husband and I, we went to church every week. I probably was doing it for show. I really don't know because I really wasn't even sure that I believed in God. That had to change, of course. Well, anyway, I cried out to God and I said, "Help me." And I meant it. I acknowledged that there was a God and I needed his help because I couldn't do it by myself. And the only thing that came back into my consciousness was that I had to go back to those darn meetings. And I didn't want to go, but I went. And this time, I listened for the ways I was. And I found lots of ways I was. Now, I hadn't done anything. I hadn't done anything that anybody told me to do. I didn't get a big book and read it. I didn't get a sponsor. I did nothing but go to those silly meetings. And when I went back, I knew I had to get a sponsor. So as I'm looking around the room, there must have been between 30 and 40 women in this meeting. And I looked around the room for who would I ask to sponsor me? There was only one woman in the room that I knew I couldn't con and manipulate. Her name was Grace. Great name. I had to approach her in the parking lot after the meeting. I was a little nervous because she was a really tough lady. And I went up to her and I said, "Grace, will you sponsor me?" Now, Grace never spoke in a normal voice to me. She always growled. So anyway, so I went up to her and I said, "Grace, will you sponsor me?" She said, "Look me in the eye." I thought I was. And she said, "Now, what did you say?" I said, "Grace, will you sponsor me?" Now, she'd seen me for 90 days in those rooms. She took her index finger and she poked me right here, hard. "Okay, Lee, I'll sponsor you." Now, I'm going to modify the word. "I'll sponsor you, but if you ever drink again, I'll rip your freaking face off." I believed her. Believe me, I believed her. She was a big woman, bigger than me. She had dyed red hair. I was a redhead. I was a natural redhead. But she had this, it was sort of like an orangey red, like Lucille Ball, color of Lucille Ball's hair. Anyway, she used to wear these muumuus with big flowers all over and flip-flops. She was a sight to behold, I'll tell you. And as I got to know her and as I got first of all, every single day, she'd say to me, You are one sick puppy. I got really tired of hearing that, you know? And she'd say it over and over, and, you know, you just remember, you are one sick puppy. But you know, there was a point in my sobriety where I realized I was one sick puppy. And that took a long time. This program works for the newcomers, I want you to know. It really, and it says in our big book, this program works, it really does. But boy, does it work infinitesimally slow. Oh, and that, that's one of my major character defects. I'm so impatient. You know, I wanted 20 years in 20 days. Anywho, she started to sponsor me. Now, AA doesn't have any rules, but Grace had rules. The first rule was, the minute your papers open in the morning, you call me. And I said, well, I'm a very early riser. She said, did you not hear me? So I called her every morning. Then she'd say to me, okay, you have to go to at least one meeting every day. And at least three of those meetings have to be meetings where I go, because I want to look you in the eye. Okay, so I'm not kidding you. I was really afraid of this woman. I really and truly was. There were people, I didn't learn this for a long time, but there were people that would come to the meeting and see her car, and they'd go to a different meeting. Now, 5 minutes. Thank you, honey. So anyway, I learned so much from this woman. When I was 5 years sober and she was giving me my cake, I said, Grace, I wouldn't be sober today if it weren't for you. And she reared back and she said, oh no, your sobriety is between you and God. I'm only here to share my experience, strength, and hope, and don't you ever forget that. Okay. You know, she was a godsend to me, though, because she had high expectations of me, and I tried to meet those for her. I think she gave me a very good foundation in this program, and I have passed on so much of her wisdom. She was a very wise woman. I've never met anyone like her. She could meet someone, and she could size them up in one meeting. And I had evidence of that as I went through sobriety. There was one woman that I became attached to. After the meeting, we used to always stand around and chat. And she came over to me one day, and she leaned into me, and she said, stay away from that one. And, you know, a little while later, she proved me right. There was a gift about her. There's only a couple of people here tonight that know Grace, but they think she was lovely. you ask any woman that she sponsored, she wasn't all horrible or anything. She, in the meetings that I went to in Canoga Park, we had, the other meetings that I've been to over the years, they have one cake a month for the people who have a birthday during that month. Grace made a cake for, if there were four people that had a birthday during that month, she'd make, from scratch, a cake for them on the very day that was their birthday, and they could either share it with the group or they could take it home with them. So she had so many wonderful ways about her that a lot of people didn't realize. She had a very good heart. Oh, I remember one day my husband and I used to go to Hawaii. My husband had a month's vacation. We used to go to Hawaii because eventually all his family moved over there. So we'd go to Hawaii, and I remember I brought her a gift home, a little souvenir from Hawaii one time. And a couple of years later. Anyway, I was over at her house one day, and she had this thing. It was magnetized on her refrigerator. She pulled it off, and she said, some idiot gave me this. And I said, that idiot was me. She never, you know, I gave her gifts for her natal birthday, her AA birthday, for Christmas. Never got a thank you. Never. Never said thank you. Not to just me, but whoever, you know. That you had to take grace, for just who she was. And I'm telling you, to this day, I am indebted to her. I don't care what she has to say, and I'm sure she'd have a mouthful to say about me. But I really and truly, there are so many wonderful people in this program. You know, I'm going to embarrass her one more time. Occasionally, I'd be at the same meeting as Sue Regan would be in, and when it was my turn to share, I'd say, there's two women that throughout my sobriety, even though I'm old, much older than they are chronologically, two women that I greatly admire. Sue was one, and June Guinan is the other. And I'd be at this meeting, and I'd say, during my share, I'd say, when I grow up, I want to be just like Sue Regan. And I know I embarrassed the heck out of her, but I'd say it, you know, all the time, because I meant it. And I still mean it to this day. I love this fellowship, truly love it. And I hope that some of you that don't know me or that I've never met before, I hope you'll come up and I get to meet you. Because, and especially the newcomers, please come up and say hi to me. Whether you believe what I've said or not, because I didn't believe a darn thing I heard at first, just keep coming back. That's the key. You don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle. And I promise you, and everyone here with any time will tell you, the miracles just keep coming. And, you know, I think, you know, you think after, okay, I got sober in March of 1980. Okay, I'm going to wind up. In March of 1980, I can't believe that I'm still learning. I hear things at meetings, I think, I never heard that before. You know, pearls of wisdom. And you know, another thing that I realized, God uses every single one of us. You may not know it, but every single one. I can recall when I'd be on the phone talking to a newcomer, and words would come out of my mouth that were not mine. Were not mine. That just floored me. I remember the first time it happened, I went, ooh, you know, it was kind of, gave me kind of the chills. But now I say, have at it, God, you know. Give me the right words. When I phone a newcomers, I always say that before they answer the phone. I say, give me the right words. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kelly.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, sweet. Thank you.
Wonderful. I'm Gail. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you.
Let's give our speakers another hand.
Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.